Welcome to Oncology Today, the management of gastroesophageal cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Samuel Klempner from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a corresponding video program with Dr. Klempner's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to discuss the various assays utilized to assay PD-L1 in upper GI cancers. It's really interesting. I used to say that like AML was the most complicated thing that we had to do in CME, and I'm starting to think upper GI cancers are starting to fall into that category. People are so confused, mainly about checkpoint inhibitors, PD-L1 levels. I mean, it's really wild what's happening. Certainly, I mean, your theme about biomarkers is very relevant, and of course, PD-1 level particularly relevant. And I'll just ask before we start going through all the data, one of the issues is the various PD-L1 assay types that are out there. Oncologists are not just dealing with upper GI cancers, all the other cancers, and in particular, the CPS approach versus the TPS approach. Is there sort of an umbrella to think about upper GI cancers in terms of that? Do you have to use the same PD-1 assay that was done in the trial?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And the largest amount of data probably exists with the 22C3 and the 28-8 antibody tests. There are others like SP142, which really have not been studied as much in upper GI cancers. And in most of the pembrolizumab-based trials, which was really kind of the first to claim the space and develop the CPS, are based on 22C3. So I think we have the most experience and perhaps comfort with 22C3, but I think 28-8 and 22C3 perform quite comparably. In terms of whether or not to use TPS or CPS, I think CPS, one, previously has been well studied in terms of marking patients more likely to benefit, and that's been our default. And certainly most of the TPS trials have been including CPS subsets, and that allows for greater comparability between the data sets. When you're looking at CheckMate 649, they've now presented with CPS-related data, so we can compare it a little more easily to, say, something like Keynote 590.
So let's talk about some of the key trials that came out. And first, we can talk about CheckMate 577, the use of nivolumab as adjuvant therapy. Can you kind of overview the design of the trial, the key findings, and how that's coming into practice?
Yeah, so CheckMate 577 is a very pragmatic and well-designed clinical trial. So this is a phase 3 trial asking the question of whether or not adjuvant nivolumab versus placebo improves disease-free survival in patients who have undergone curative intent trimodality therapy. So just as a little bit of background, most esophageal cancers, well, a majority of them still receive neoadjuvant chemoradiation per the CROSS trial. So this is carbopaclitaxel radiation followed by a curative intent surgery. And unfortunately, despite that improvement compared to surgery alone, the vast majority of patients, probably 75% or more, don't achieve a pathologic complete response. The patients that do do quite well, but the vast majority that don't. So we've been really kind of needing therapies for this population that have a very high risk of recurrence. And so for reference, the risk of recurrence of someone who has less than a pathologic CR after trimodality therapy is probably, well, the median disease-free survival is around 11 months. And so that tells you right away that there's a very high-risk patient. So this trial was built on that background, and they said, let's take these patients and randomize them 2-to-1 to nivolumab or placebo for adjuvant therapy. The primary endpoint was disease-free survival. And so this trial included adenocarcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. And really the take-home point is that in the intent-to-treat population, so everybody, the median disease-free survival was improved from 11 months in the control arm, the placebo arm, to 22 months in the nivolumab-containing arm. So this was a clinically meaningful doubling of the disease-free survival. And this was, of course, a highly statistically significant result. A few minor comments just to keep with the biomarker theme. There are some groups that are driving greater benefit than others, but I think this is a high-risk population, and we've been offering this to a lot of patients. Whether or not this will hold with some of the other strategies that are involved and being developed in the neoadjuvant space, of course, we don't entirely know. We'll await future data, but this was a very practical trial and certainly practice-changing for a lot of our patients.
What do we know about benefits in patients with PD-1 negative tumors?
Yeah, so the numbers, of course, get a little small when you try to parse out all of the details, but it's been consistent with other trials. So I'll call out a few subgroups. If you look at the GE junction adenocarcinoma patients in CheckMate 577, the hazard ratio is significantly lower. These patients, as a group, are deriving less benefit if you say compare them to the squamous cell population where they have a greater degree of benefit. You can further enrich that for, say, a squamous cell that's PD-L1 positive or an adenocarcinoma that's PD-L1 positive. This was done primarily by tumor cell scoring. So that's what's presented, but the additional data that's available, they have shown it by CPS. And so, not surprisingly, the patients with PD-L1 positive tumors do derive a little greater magnitude of benefit. And then I think this is just consistent with the biomarker enrichment that we've seen across immunotherapy studies.
So it's interesting how different tumor subspecialties deal with data. Because a lot of times when you see early adjuvant data, where you only have a disease-free survival benefit too early for survival, you get pushback when implementing it, particularly if the hazard rate's not all that great. In lung cancer, osimertinib, the hazard rate was 0.2, so there wasn't as much discussion. But the argument comes in, maybe you just wait and treat them on relapse. It was interesting, we were doing a lung cancer webinar and we saw the results. It wasn't adjuvant, but it was metastatic in ALK. And there, they saw this tremendous benefit when they used alectinib, but one of the trials allowed crossover, and they just reported the survival benefit, zero benefit, even though they get this huge disease-free survival benefit. Obviously, a different cancer, different strategy. But are you hearing those kinds of discussions about this situation, or are people just accept the fact it's very likely to have a survival benefit?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we see the shape of the curves and the fact that they're staying quite separated and the magnitude, the absolute magnitude of the difference, I think many of us are expecting to see a persistent benefit translate to a survival improvement. But you make a very fair point, whether or not subsequent therapies and improved subsequent care can wash some of this out is to be determined. We haven't seen survival. My personal opinion is that I do think the survival benefit will hold here. And really, I think there's a lot of inertia in the gastroesophageal community and patient community really to try to do anything you can to potentially enhance your cure rate. And that's really what we're hoping to do in the non-metastatic setting. And so I think the appetite is maybe a little bit higher and people are willing to accept some of the nuances a little bit more than we do in the metastatic setting.
So another question is, how far can you go outside the trial boundaries, assuming you can get treatment paid for? I've heard of a number of scenarios brought up to me by docs. One has been the patient who gets chemo radiation and then decides they don't want to go to surgery with or without documented persistent disease. Another question I've heard about is patients who get FLOT and whether it's applicable to that scenario without surgery.
Yeah, I think here I would say I'm a little bit more conservative, again, because we're talking about cures and trying to enhance the cure rate, and those are situations where we just don't have large data sets. I do think there's some important studies that are trying to address some of these questions. I mean, we know that giving adjuvant chemotherapy after an esophagectomy or a gastrectomy is very difficult, and we've seen that with FLOT and MAGIC. And so there are some studies looking at upfront FLOT and adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor, plus or minus other things, CTLA-4, et cetera. And I think really the field is hopefully slowly moving towards improving neoadjuvant therapies where we can really start to entertain the idea of, can we select patients who may not need to undergo surgery? Can we get good enough at picking these patients out where we can spare this potential large surgery? And I think many institutions are starting to think this way in squamous cell cancers of the esophagus, and adenos are still a little bit more difficult. But to answer your question, no, I think we haven't really taken this outside of the bounds of 577. I think there's interest in whether or not this strategy would be applicable to patients who do have a path CR or patients who received other perioperative therapies. And there's also a lot of interest in moving the checkpoint inhibitor into the neoadjuvant component, so chemo radiation plus pembro. And there's some large data sets in unresectable patients, like KEYNOTE-985, I think, that will help to answer some of these questions.
So let's move on and talk about metastatic disease, specifically first-line therapy. Can you provide an overview of the data sets that we've had to contemplate now in the last year and what your thoughts are about what it means in practice?
I'll try to summarize a very large topic in a few minutes. So I think in the largest patient data sets that are probably applicable to most people practicing in the US are KEYNOTE 590 and CheckMate 649. There is the ATTRACTION trial as well, and CheckMate 648, which was presented but not published. Again, that's a squamous trial. So I'll walk through this a little bit. So when a newly diagnosed metastatic patient walks into our clinic, unfortunately, that's the vast majority of patients that I see, and I think many of us see, we're faced with someone who has a poor prognosis and similar questions to other cancer types. And so I think the first step is really identifying biomarkers. And I do think that HER2, PD-L1, and mismatch repair should be tested in all patients as the minimum. And so these trials all attempted to answer a similar question, which is, if we add immune checkpoint inhibitor, in this case, anti-PD-1 antibodies, on top of standard chemo, can we improve outcomes in newly diagnosed metastatic patients? So the first trial I'll mention is CheckMate 649. So this is a very large trial, about 1,500 patients. So one of the largest gastric cancer data sets and GE junction that we've seen to date. And this was newly diagnosed patients with GE junction gastric and a very small portion of esophageal cancer, all adenocarcinomas. They were randomized to 5-FU platinum plus nivolumab or without nivolumab. And the primary endpoints were overall survival and progression-free survival in the CPS greater than 5 population. So here we're using the more standard CPS scoring criteria for PD-L1. Of course, they included outcomes in the all randomized, the CPS less than 5 and CPS less than 1. And what we saw is that in the primary population, CPS greater than 5, the addition of nivolumab on top of standard 5-FU platinum improved overall survival, roughly in absolute magnitude of a little over 3 months. Notably, this was the first trial in a largely unselected patient population to have a median overall survival over a year. So that is a notable improvement for our patients. But again, I think some themes emerge from this trial, which include the magnitude of benefit is tightly related here to the degree of PD-L1 expression. So if you move down and take everyone with a score less than 5, the hazard ratio is actually 0.9 something. And so it appears that the less expressing patients really are not deriving significant magnitude of benefit. So the FDA has left it up to clinicians to weigh the pros and cons of incorporating anti-PD-1 agents into the frontline population. So the label is independent of PD-L1 testing results. But I think in practice, many of us are not using these drugs in patients with CPS negative tumors or PD-L1 less than 5. It does raise an important issue about discordance between testing different sites and different times, and whether or not we should retest all our patients. I think I always try to give patients the benefit of the doubt. And if we have multiple specimens, we'll try to test multiple specimens, because if one of them is a CPS greater than 5 and the other one is a 4 or a 3 or a 2, like, I will give the patient the benefit of the doubt and offer them checkpoint inhibitor in that setting. The next trial was KEYNOTE 590. And so this was asking a very similar question, except this is a primarily esophageal cancer trial. So this is squames and adenos of the esophagus primarily. And this was pembrolizumab in addition to 5-FU platinum for newly diagnosed patients. And they had some pre-specified groups that they planned to analyze, both the squames greater than 10, all the squames, all patients with CPS scores greater than 10, and then everyone randomized. And again, a very similar observation. The squamous cell population that had a CPS score of 10 or higher had a significant improvement in outcomes and survival. I think the hazard ratio is around 0.5 something, and a overall survival of around 9 versus 14 point something months. So this is, again, a selected group, but certainly deriving a lot of benefit. The trial was technically positive in the all squamous population and the PD-L1 positive randomized, all randomized population. If you look in the supplement of the paper, which was just published, you can see that, again, in some of these groups, like the squamous PD-L1 less than 10, the magnitude of benefit is decreasing. And so again, the FDA has left it up to the clinicians to decide how they're going to interpret and incorporate these drugs into the frontline population. I think in my own practice, in squamous with a PD-L1 score greater than 10, definitely this is our standard. In patients with CPS negative tumors, we definitely have some reservations and it's a discussion. And then in adenocarcinomas with CPS greater than 10, again, feel very comfortable that we're helping that patient. And then in the negative population, have been hesitant to use it. Again, a discussion of the pros and cons and the data with our patients.
Can you comment on the CheckMate 648 study and future or maybe soon current role of Ipi-Nivo?
Yeah, so 648 was the most recent data set. Again, this is another very large trial. And so kudos to the investigators for conducting this trial. This was an all squamous population. And this was asking a similar question, but with an additional variation. So they were asking, does the addition of nivolumab improve outcomes versus standard chemotherapy in squamous cell patients of the esophagus? But also, we've seen some activity for Ipi-Nivo in gastric and esophageal cancer patients. And in a population of patients with squamous cell carcinomas, can you get away without chemotherapy? So there's two comparisons here. There's chemo plus Nivo versus chemo, and then there's Ipi-Nivo versus chemo. And both of those comparisons were actually positive in the tumor cell scoring greater than one population. Again, I think this was an overall survival endpoint, and we saw them meet their endpoints in both of these groups. It's a little bit unclear in my own mind how I would incorporate this in practice. I think the chemotherapy plus PD-1 outcomes were good, and the response rate was a little bit higher in that group compared to the Ipi-Nivo group, although the comparison between those two groups was not formally tested. But they did meet their pre-specified endpoint for a chemo-free combination. So we expect that we may have some regulatory ruling on Ipi-Nivo as an option for squamous cell patients of the esophagus. How to select patients in terms of who would you give Ipi-Nivo to and who would you give FOLFOX plus Nivo to with a squam, I think is not entirely clear in my own mind. And I haven't really thought exactly how I would make that decision. Certainly people with existing neuropathies and relative contraindications to chemotherapy, it would be nice to have a chemo-free option. But of course, Ipi-Nivo has some well-established toxicity profiles that also need to be factored in. So if we have the combination approved, I think it's still a thoughtful discussion on kind of an individualized basis on how you're going to select between 5-FU platinum and Nivo versus Ipi-Nivo if both are available.
I was just kind of flashing. You wouldn't normally think this question with Ipi-Nivo, but I kind of wonder whether in an older, frail patient, they might tolerate it better than chemo-Nivo. Any observations or thoughts? It's Nivo-3, Ipi-1. Do you think it's better tolerated than chemo in an older person or not necessarily?
Yeah, I think not necessarily, but I do think that that is the right Ipi-Nivo dosing combination to study and carry forward as opposed to the converse. And so I do think that they chose well there. There's a large phase 3 trial from the UK group recently in JAMA Oncology called the GO2 trial. And this was a frontline gastroesophageal population asking the question of, can you get away with lower dose 5-FU, in this case, CAPOX? So they had three arms, full dose CAPOX, like 20% and 40% reduction in CAPOX. And what they showed was that starting off at pretty significant dose reductions, they had similar response rates, similar progression-free survival, and similar overall survival, I believe, in this population. So essentially in the more older and perhaps more frail population, we may be able to get away with actually using lower dose chemotherapy. And I've been doing that, and I do think that that's actually a pretty well-tolerated combination. So outside, I've definitely done dose-reduced FOLFOX in an extrapolation from GO2 in combination with nivolumab. So far, so good.
Interesting. You were verbalizing your hesitancy to use IO with a PD-1 low situation. Any more reason to think about it with Ipi-Nivo? Any more data there?
Yeah, I think it's always been a question of whether or not the addition of CTLA-4 can overcome that selection on PD-L1. And I don't think we've seen very large data sets that answer this question. CheckMate 648, again, with the TPS positive greater than 1% population, we are selecting for people who are slightly enriched. So I don't think we answered the question there. Interesting question. I don't have a clear answer for you on that one.
So let's talk a little bit about HER2 positive disease. And I got to say, I was really surprised. I think it was in May, all of a sudden, an email comes across my desk saying new first line therapy for HER2 positive gastric cancer. I started asking the breast people if they ever heard of this. And even now, they still haven't heard of it. But all of a sudden, the approval actually was before we saw the data at ASCO. So TOGA plus PEMBRO, pretty much, chemo, trastuzumab, and PEMBRO. Can you talk about the data in this KEYNOTE 811 study? And is that something you're utilizing in your practice now?
Yeah, I believe it was Cinco de Mayo. We saw the approval, and you're right, it was ahead of ASCO, so an early gift. And so the data is very encouraging. And just for a little bit of background, as you mentioned, the TOGA trial really established the incorporation of HER2-directed therapies in gastric and esophageal cancers. Essentially, this was cisplatin 5-FU plus or minus trastuzumab, and we saw an overall survival improvement. Again, in keeping with the biomarker theme, if you actually look at the TOGA, the survival outcomes for people who are 3+ versus lower or with HER2 amplification ratios that are higher actually can further enrich for patients who do even better. So in the FISH more amplified patients, the survival is around 16 months. But still, was room to improve. And there had been prior HER2 strategies that had failed in the frontline and second line setting. And so there was some preclinical evidence that if you combine monoclonal antibodies, which of course have an antibody-dependent cytotoxicity component and may manipulate some immune cell populations on the innate arm of the immune system, if you combine that with a checkpoint inhibitor where you're reinvigorating adaptive immune response through primarily anti-tumor T cells, that you could enhance activity. So the group at Memorial Sloan Kettering built upon that preclinical rationale and did essentially a precursor to 811. They did 5-FU platinum, PEMBRO, and trastuzumab in a single-arm trial. They showed a very high response rate, I believe in the 90s. And they also suggested that this activity was not clearly related to PD-L1 expression. Again, this is a relatively small data set. So to validate those findings, KEYNOTE 811 was designed and launched. And this is a phase 3 trial. Again, a clean and well-designed trial that's asking a relatively simple question, which is if you take TOGA and you add pembrolizumab, can you improve survival? So it's a 1-to-1 randomization for newly diagnosed gastric and GE junction adenocarcinoma patients of 5-FU platinum. In most patients, this is CAPOX, plus trastuzumab with pembrolizumab or placebo. The primary endpoint is overall survival. And all that we've seen so far, as you suggested at ASCO, is the first interim analysis really looking at response rate. But there are some really interesting observations. And first of all, just the people that went on to the trial, this is mainly a gastric cancer population, a little over 2/3 of patients with gastric cancer. It's really relatively high HER2-expressing tumors, and so about 80% of patients have 3+ positive tumors, and about 20% are 2+ and FISH positive. And interestingly, maybe even a little bit unexpectedly, about 85% or more of these patients happen to be PD-L1 positive, in this case by CPS. But what we've seen is that the response rate with the addition of pembrolizumab went to 75% from the control arm of 52%. So talking about a little over a 22% improvement in response rate from adding one drug, which is of course more than you would get from just experience with frontline checkpoint inhibitor alone. There's more complete responses. The depth of response seems to be greater. If you look at the waterfall plots themselves, you can see just the shape of the waterfall. There's a lot more bars that are diving lower in the experimental arm. What we don't know is the more hard clinical outcomes of overall survival and progression-free survival, which are the primary endpoints of the trial. But based on this really encouraging activity, the FDA went ahead and approved this combination for this population, only dependent on HER2, does not depend on PD-L1 testing. It's only for adenocarcinomas. And I mean, this is an active regimen. I think anyone who's used this has seen some of these responses, which can be quite impressive. So we are using this. I do think it's an active regimen. We do have some HER2 positive trials, which is a luxury of an academic center. So if we don't have a trial, then this has been our go-to unless there's a contraindication to checkpoint inhibitor.
You mentioned that it seems like almost all these patients are PD-1 positive. Are you also using it in patients who are PD-1 negative? Do we know whether this benefits patients who are PD-1 negative?
Yeah, it's really a good question. It does seem that pembrolizumab does have a greater magnitude of benefit in CPS and PD-L1 positive patients. That, I think, is consistent throughout the trial literature. Whether or not that holds in this population, we don't know. The PD-L1 negative population is going to be a very small subset of this trial, as almost 85% or more are PD-L1 positive. I think the degree of positivity is still relevant, whether these are like the CPS5 patients in CheckMate 649 who do well, or whether they're mostly 1-5s, we'll see, maybe. And at least from the phase 2 data, there was definitely activity in PD-L1 negative patients. And so we at our institution have been offering this independent of PD-L1 testing based on the available data. And I do think that it is worth a shot. But you're right, there is a risk that the activity could be lower in PD-L1 negative patients. It's going to be a little bit tricky to see that cleanly from what I anticipate to be a relatively small subset of patients.
So let's talk about second line and beyond for HER2 positive disease. And let me stop and ask about HER2 assays in gastroesophageal cancers. What percent of patients are HER2 positive, HER2 low? What assay methodology is used? And in particular, do you retest people in the second or third line to see if HER2 is still there, either liquid or tissue?
Yes. So I think most institutions generally follow the ASCO CAP guidelines, which have been out for a little while for HER2 testing. So really, this is defining positivity as IHC 3+ or IHC 2+ with FISH amplified disease in a ratio of 2 or higher. And so those are traditionally the HER2 positive population. HER2 low is the group that we're interested in. Just like the breast cancer world has shown some activity in some of the HER2 low populations. But for the majority of trials, the selection has been at the ASCO CAP definition, which is what our institution uses to call positivity as well. In terms of do we retest, I think biologically and academically, we're very interested in the evolution of HER2 positive disease over the course of treatment lines. Whether or not we're eliminating HER2 positive clones using HER2 agents, and therefore when you retest a patient, you run the risk that they would be HER2 negative because you have effectively eliminated the HER2 positive clone. I think we have seen some data to suggest that that may be the case in a significant population of patients. And again, aligning with a biomarker idea, to try to optimally select patients for later line therapies that are biologically selected for based on a biomarker, we are retesting. So when patients progress on trastuzumab, 5-FU platinum, maybe with pembro, we're biopsying to try to understand what are the things that are changing. Are there new resistance mechanism? What is the status of HER2? There's also a lot of heterogeneity within HER2 expression at baseline and after therapy. So we know from some prior work from colleagues, including several you've had on your show and podcast, that have shown pretty convincingly that if you biopsy a primary tumor and a metastatic site, that there are known rates of discordance between those. So you can have a HER2 positive primary and a HER2 negative metastasis. So that's spatial heterogeneity. And then, of course, over time, you can have some temporal heterogeneity where someone could have a HER2 positive initial biopsy, and then subsequent to a HER2 therapy could have a HER2 negative biopsy. Exactly how those findings translate to impact on outcome, I think, is not entirely clear. And we are also doing this in parallel from blood. Amplifications from blood are sometimes a little bit less reliably detectable. But certainly, I think some of the trends that we see is that someone who's HER2 positive from tissue and HER2 positive from circulating tumor DNA, those patients tend to have those really nice responses that we see. The people that may have more of discordant results are kind of a little bit all over the place. the impact on later line therapies is really, I would say, not convincingly determined. There's been some biomarker data from the DESTINY trial, and certainly there does appear to be activity across the groups.
So another thing that I can remember hearing even back in the TOGA days is the issue of, quote, heterogeneity in HER2 expression at the same point in time. And I kind of had the feeling that there was this belief there was more heterogeneity than breast cancer. You hear it discussed more in GI cancers. What are the implications of that? Do you ever think about getting multiple biopsies? Is liquid biopsy more important because it reflects the total HER2 status?
Yeah, it's a great question and an interest of many people in the field. So you're exactly right. If you take a biopsy of a primary gastric tumor or, say, a liver metastasis, and you stain multiple regions of the same core, you can definitely find regions within the same tumor that have differing levels of HER2 expression, including parts of the tumor that would be called HER2 positive by standard metrics and parts of the tumor that would be called HER2 negative by the same assessment. We certainly think that heterogeneity does impact outcomes. As to why there's more heterogeneity in gastroesophageal cancers than, say, in breast cancer, I think there's a bunch of theories, and it may have to do with the underlying mechanisms of tumorigenesis in some of these tumors. We see a lot of chromosomal instability and potentially earlier divergence of subclonal populations that may give rise to this heterogeneity. And how it impacts outcomes, I think it is clear to me, and I think from some smaller data sets, that patients who really have a FISH highly amplified tumor and a amplification detectable in the blood essentially start to think of that as a surrogate for how dependent is the tumor on the HER2 pathway. And so those are patients you would hypothesize that if you block the HER2 pathway, you're likely to have a very good response. And at least from some of the data that's out there, I think that that trend does hold. HER2 positive tissue with concordant HER2 positive blood is identifying a group who are more likely to benefit. Similarly, I would imagine that if you had a concordant PD-L1 testing from a primary and a metastatic site that were both, say, greater than 5, that might be someone who's more likely to benefit than someone who has a PD-L1 negative primary and a PD-L1 positive metastasis. But that area is a little less clear. But yes, HER2 heterogeneity is a big topic. I do think it impacts outcomes. More heterogeneity likely is associated with lesser degree of benefit from the HER2-directed therapy. Of course, we don't really have standardized metrics of heterogeneity assessment, so it's a little bit hard to bucket these patients beyond just positive and negative.
Can you talk a little bit about the efficacy endpoints that we're seeing in this DESTINY-Gastric01 study? And right now, where you're utilizing it, and specifically, whether you utilize it in second line or third line, for example.
So the HER2 landscape has gotten a little bit more complex, and I think this is, again, ultimately a good thing for patients. But previously, we didn't really have any options for HER2-directed therapy after frontline trastuzumab-containing regimens. And so the DESTINY Gastric was building upon an interesting drug, trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is a HER2 agent conjugated to a topoisomerase payload that is obviously delivered to HER2-expressing tumors. And so the DESTINY-Gastric01 was really to validate some of the earlier work with trastuzumab deruxtecan. And so this was HER2-expressing gastric or GE junction adenocarcinomas, and this could be based on archival testing to get into the trial. Patients had to have greater than or equal to 2 prior regimens. So this was really a third line and later trial, and you had to have seen 5-FU and platinum. This was an Asian trial conducted entirely in Japan and Korea, and the HER2 positivity was defined as 3+ or 2+ with FISH positivity. What's been reported in the New England Journal population is the standard HER2 positive cohorts. And this was a randomization of 2-to-1 to trastuzumab deruxtecan versus physician choice chemotherapy. So that physician choice was irinotecan or paclitaxel. The primary endpoint here was response rate, but they did have pre-specified secondary endpoints of overall survival and progression-free survival. So if you look at the study population to see who actually went on to the trial, some notable things is, again, this is a heavily pretreated population. So half or more are treated in the third and fourth line beyond in this trial. And about a third of these had had prior checkpoint inhibitor. Everyone had prior trastuzumab. A bunch of people had prior irinotecan or topo-1 inhibitors as well. And the primary outcome with overall response rate, we saw a significant greater degree of activity with trastuzumab deruxtecan. The response rate was around 50% in the trastuzumab deruxtecan arm, versus around 14% in the physician choice chemotherapy. So a lot more responders, suggesting the biological activity of the drug. And certainly that's a clinically meaningful endpoint to me, with response often associated with improvement in symptoms. But more importantly, what we saw is that the overall survival differences between the two arms, the patients who received trastuzumab deruxtecan had a median overall survival just over a year, I think 12.5 months or so, versus the physician choice arm was around 8.4 months in a later line. So these are great outcomes for a heavily pretreated population. Your question about whether or not using this in the second line, I think, is a very good one and something we think about a lot, because technically the trial only studied third line and later patients. And so we really have no data in one, Western populations, and two, the true second line setting. However, I think the activity is real and the responses are real. And I think the FDA recognized that by making the label quite broad, so that the label allows for second line use in US guidelines. I think at ESMO this year, we will see some data from the trastuzumab deruxtecan trial in Western patients. And so we'll have a little bit more context, and maybe I'll be able to give you a better answer to the second line question about data. In my own practice, I have generally not been using this in the second line setting, partly because we have several trials, and certainly I'm a strong believer in clinical trials where they're available. And so we have looked at some HER2 agents in the second line and later setting on trial. Outside of a trial, I have used this in third line and later. And a couple times I have used in the second line after discussion with patients. And in one particular situation, this was primarily driven by patient, very informed patient. But primarily, I have been giving this in the third line or later, because I think that's really where the data is.
So a final issue about T-DXd, of course, is the interstitial lung disease. This is discussed in our lung cancer programs and our breast cancer programs. What do we know about that specifically in these patients? And is there anything that can be done in terms of picking it up early? Does picking it up early help?
Yeah, it's a good question. Certainly our breast cancer colleagues and lung cancer colleagues have more experience in totality with the agent, and maybe perhaps pneumonitis more and interstitial lung disease in general. But yes, it's a known side effect of the drug. And somewhere in the 10% or greater patients will develop interstitial lung disease. I think this is something we're all learning. Just like with any new drug, there's definitely a learning curve. Frequent assessments, frequent symptom checks. I know some people are considering more frequent baseline x-rays and even pulmonary function tests in some settings. I think that patients often tell us, if we ask them, are you noticing any clinical differences? I think there's a whole spectrum of this presentation, from completely incidental imaging findings, which I have definitely observed, to, of course, clinically symptomatic patients who need immediate discontinuation of the drug and therapy for interstitial lung disease. I think the guidelines that are available to recognize and monitor and treat are very conservative and well-written. And so I've certainly refreshed myself many times with the trastuzumab deruxtecan interstitial lung disease guidance. And when I've observed the interstitial lung disease, have followed it essentially to the T.
So let's talk a little bit more about some other data sets and other issues. And one I'm curious about is the issue of TAS-102 in gastroesophageal cancer. What do we know about it? Do you utilize it? And also, I'm curious, in colon, you hear about, it's utilized a lot, TAS-102 plus Bev, whether that's something that's been looked at, or even anti-angiogenics.
Yeah, it's a very relevant topic. And I'll just step back for a second and say that with all the enthusiasm on frontline therapies, essentially everybody progresses on frontline therapy. And so there's really still a need for later line drug development. Paclitaxel and ramucirumab and fulfirine ramucirumab, I think, are established later line therapies. Paclitaxel and ramucirumab is a well-recognized global standard and may actually even be underutilized. But patients will progress on second line therapies as well. So there is really a clinical need for later line therapies. And TAS-102, trifluridine tipiracil, really was developed in this setting. So a couple of years ago, there was a phase 3 trial called TAGS. And this was essentially asking the question of, does TAS-102 improve survival versus best supportive care and placebo in patients with heavily pretreated gastric and GE junction adenocarcinomas? So they did this study. It was primarily gastric cancer patients. These are heavily pretreated patients. I think about two-thirds had three or more prior lines of therapy. So really a late line trial. And these are patients who had seen the spectrum. They had seen platinum 5-FU, taxane, irinotecan, ramucirumab. A small portion at the time had seen checkpoint inhibitor. And really what they showed, I think, is largely consistent with the colorectal literature. So there was an improvement in overall survival, which was the primary endpoint, of about 2 months to 5.7 months in the TAS-102 arm. Interestingly, and consistent with colon data, the response rates, the true RECIST responses, are low. It was 4% in the trial, I believe. But the disease control rate is real. 44% of the patient in the TAGS trial, that was the disease control rate, versus 14 in the placebo arm. So the FDA approved this drug in 2019 based on this data. But I think many of us, and the uptake has been relatively low, primarily because of the relatively low response rates and still the feel that if there's a trial available, we should continue to try to push in patients who are trial candidates. But one of the strategies that has been attractive is combining TAS-102 with anti-angiogenics. And certainly, as you suggested, there's been some activity in colorectal cancers with TAS-102 and bevacizumab. And now we have some data in gastric cancer with ramucirumab, another VEGF agent, in this case, a VEGFR2 antibody. So with this thinking and rationale, this Asian group did a trial of TAS-102 and ramucirumab, and they did some kind of cool things, in my opinion. They had two groups. One was a second line without prior ramucirumab. One was a greater than or equal to third line, including prior ramucirumab. And the response rate was relatively low, but better than the TAGS trial. So the response rate was, I think, between 9 and 15% between those two groups. And so certainly at least additive, if not synergistic, between the ramucirumab and the TAS-102. And then in really a subset that kind of caught my eye was that in this case, they had a reasonable portion of patients who had prior immunotherapy, because this is a very recent publication in 2021. And when they looked at the people who had prior IO agents, the response rates were substantially higher to TAS-102 and RAM, including both the patients who had prior RAM and no prior RAM. So I think this is an interesting observation, and certainly the authors appropriately called it out. It does also parallel some things that we've seen retrospectively with post-IO therapies. And so there's some retrospective, one from Asia, one from the US, looking at the activity of ramucirumab-containing regimens after prior IO. And this is primarily with paclitaxel. But interestingly, they saw a similar trend. The activity is above and beyond what you would expect for ramucirumab in the trial population that hadn't had prior IO. So whether or not the PD-L1 is manipulating the microenvironment and presenting a perhaps situation where VEGF inhibition is advantageous, we don't entirely know. But nonetheless, it's a observation that's been seen a few times and something that may become clinically more relevant as we see more PD-1 use in the frontline.
When I first heard about this, my first thought was this was just the PD-1 hanging around. I know it has a long half-life. Is that the thinking, that it's the PD-1 still on board? And it's really, you're combining TAS-102, RAM, and PD-1?
Yeah, I think, as you say, these drugs do definitely hang around. And that's certainly a possibility. I think at some level, we have seen some triplet combinations. There's a trial of paclitaxel, RAM, and PD-1 given concurrently in patients who don't have prior PD-1 exposure that also suggests some perhaps enhanced activity. So hard to say if it's sequence combination or a reprogramming from the prior PD-1 exposure without the drug still hanging around. And it will take some larger data sets and more experience to cleanly tease that apart. But you raise a good point, whether it's the hanging around of the drug itself or the effect of the drug on the remodeling of the microenvironment that is driving this observation.
Certainly, you see anti-angiogenics, both TKIs and antibodies being combined with IOs. A lot of success, renal cell, TKI IO, HCC, Bev and IO. So it's not like we haven't seen this before.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's some interest in moving some of these combinations into earlier lines. Lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, which seemed like a cure-all in cancer and had activity across a lot of different disease types, including gastric cancer. We've seen some pembro and lenvatinib data, and there are some ongoing trials moving that combination into the frontline in combination with chemotherapy. And there's also similar data with regorafenib and nivolumab, and some interest in trying to move these combinations earlier based on exactly what you say. I do think it speaks to the fact that in the frontline patients, all these PD-L1 negative patients are really not the group that are benefiting from checkpoint inhibitor, but perhaps the addition of anti-angiogenesis can overcome that and expand the group of patients who may benefit from these combinations. So I think time will tell, but it's definitely a strategy that has scientific rationale and a lot of orthogonal support from other tumor types.
So a couple of agents that are still in development, bemarituzumab, I've heard it called BEMA, FGFR2 inhibitor. Can you talk a little bit about how it works, how often you see FGFR2, and what we know about this agent?
Yeah, so this target has garnered a lot of attention, and appropriately so. So FGFR2 is a transmembrane receptor tyrosine kinase. It is a target that's seen across other tumor types, bladder, cholangiocarcinoma, etc. And bemarituzumab is a monoclonal antibody that binds to the extracellular domain, and so it blocks the ability of FGFR2 to bind its ligand and then signal. And then, similar to other monoclonal antibodies, just like the rationale for KEYNOTE-811 with pembro and trastuzumab, there is an antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity where you're recruiting immune cells, primarily in the innate arm with NK cells and macrophages, to drive some of the anti-tumor response. It's a target that purely by amplification, it's not very common, probably in the 5% range. But if you look at expression by immunohistochemistry, it becomes significantly greater portion of the population. This drug was tested in an earlier phase 1 monotherapy trial in gastric cancer, FGFR2B positive patients. And I think the response rate was like 15 or 16%. So I remember when I saw that, I was actually encouraged because in a later line single agent antibody with a response rate of 16%, I mean, it really suggests that you've got a biomarker that's identifying a biology, which is really one of the critical aspects of any biomarker. Is it identifying and distinguishing two biologically different populations? And so based on that single agent activity, they moved the agent earlier into the front line and designed this trial called FIGHT 101. And so these were newly diagnosed patients, metastatic gastric or GE junction adenocarcinomas. You had to have FGFR2B overexpression or FGFR2 amplification, and you couldn't be HER2 positive because those patients have a established therapy. And then interestingly and very practically, and I think this is a point that we will see more and more in trials in targeted agents, they allowed for patients to have one cycle of essentially induction FOLFOX during screening while you're waiting for the biomarker results. So a lot of these patients are very symptomatic, and so we don't want to wait too long for a biomarker test before we initiate therapy. So they recognized that clinical problem and adjusted the trial appropriately and actually quite cleverly. So patients, once they had their FGFR2B status, were then randomized to FOLFOX plus placebo or FOLFOX plus bemarituzumab. Primary endpoint in the FIGHT 101 was amended to progression-free survival. If you look at the people that went on the trial, it's about half of the patients that got induction FOLFOX, that one cycle. And then the vast majority of the patients were identified by immunohistochemistry. But to get back to your point about heterogeneity and concordance, they did, to their credit, try to study this a little bit. So they looked at ctDNA and next-gen sequencing from tissue, and they have reported the rates of overlap between those biomarker populations. But really, what got a lot of the press was the outcomes. And so the progression-free survival in the intention-to-treat population, so it's about 150 patients, the median PFS was 9.5 months in the experimental arm. And so that's a very encouraging PFS in a frontline trial. We're used to seeing FOLFOX median PFSs in the 4 to 6 range. And the control arm in this case was 7.4. But I think more importantly and biologically relevant is that if you look at the patients who had a greater degree of the biomarker expression, so this was IHC 2+, 3+ in greater than 5% of cells and greater than 10, the PFS difference and absolute increase continues to rise with greater expression of the biomarker. So, for example, in the most selected patients, the PFS IHC 2+, 3+ in greater than 10%, the PFS is 14.1 months. That's a PFS. It's a survival that we're used to. And then if you look at the overall survival, equally encouraging results from this data set. In again, that ultimate biomarker selected group, the median OS was greater than 2 years. But in the overall population, they still had nearly a 6-month improvement in overall survival. It's probably driven a little bit by those really biomarker-enriched patients. But I think it speaks to our discussion a little bit earlier about biomarker expression and association with outcomes. And so here, if you're cherry-picking the most highly expressing patients, you get the best outcomes. But certainly the improvement does extend to people with lower levels of the biomarker.
So one final agent, I'm curious what your thoughts are. And I hope this agent works out because I really like the name zolbetuximab. So Claudin 18.2, another target. Can you talk about that, what we know about that, and what we know about zolbetuximab?
Yeah, if we call the last one Bema, I guess we'll have to call this Zolbi or something.
Yeah. But,
yes. Claudin 18.2, it's an interesting biomarker. So it's a tight junction protein that's generally only expressed really on the basal side of the gastric epithelium, and it controls communication between cells like any tight junction protein. In gastric cancer, it's often repolarized and moved to the epithelial side, where, of course, it's available as a drug target. And what's interesting is that there you have a cancer-restricted target. So the target of your drug is restricted to the tumor cells, which is, of course, attractive in drug development and potentially limiting off-target toxicity. It's interestingly overexpressed. And when we say overexpressed, we mean greater than 75% of cells staining. This is from the current trials. About 1/3 of patients will overexpress Claudin 18.2. So its prevalence is pretty high for a biomarker, which is also attractive because it may mark a substantial portion of the patients coming through our front door. It's currently being studied in 2 phase 3 international trials, one called Spotlight and one called Glow. And one is combined with FOLFOX and the other is combined with CAPOX, just to reflect regional practices. And of course, if these phase 3 trials are positive, we'll introduce another biomarker. Similar to Keynote 811, there's also interest in combining this agent with checkpoint inhibitors, so FOLFOX, Zolbi, plus PD-1, and certainly we'll ultimately see some data there. But the data that's out there and what's been presented and published is from this FAST trial. And so this was a trial now a few years ago in Europe where they looked at EOX, which was a standard frontline at the time, versus EOX plus zolbetuximab. And again, consistent with what we've been talking about, in the overall population, this was Claudin 18.2 positive, you saw a improvement in overall survival. But if you move the biomarker threshold to call a little bit higher, so the 70% positive patients, 70% staining as a positive cutoff, we saw that the median PFS really essentially doubled between these two agents from 8.9 to 16.5 months when you added the zolbetuximab. So consistent with the idea that this is a biomarker selecting for a biology and clearly associated with some differential outcomes. It's a phase 2 trial of about a little over 100 something patients. So we'll await the phase 3, but I agree with you. I think Claudin 18.2 is a biomarker that's worthy of study and we'll just have to see the phase 3s.
So let's talk about, you had a couple of patients here, beginning with a 63-year-old man, compensated alcohol cirrhosis and a bunch of other comorbidities. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there, how he presented?
Yeah, I wanted to bring a couple of cases to highlight some of the points that you raised. And so this is a really nice guy. I grew up on a farm, and so he's a tractor mechanic, and we've talked a lot about preparing tractors, certainly much more skilled than me. But he presented, unfortunately, like many of our patients, with advanced disease, and he had impact in his ability to swallow, and initial scans had significant regional and distant adenopathy, including a very large, bulky tumor beginning at the GE junction, and this was biopsy-proven disease. Our standard has been to test tissue, both for standard biomarkers, which is HER2, mismatch repair, and PD-L1. We've done next-gen sequencing on all the patients at diagnosis, and then we try to collect circulating tumor DNA. And I'll be the first to admit that that's above and beyond the standard, but it's geared toward the idea that we want to understand as much about the tumor biology as possible to subset these patients, largely for clinical trials, but also to try to understand impact of biomarkers on outcomes. And so his biomarker testing was notable for a PD-L1 positive tumor. The CPS score was 18 here, and we used the 22C3 antibody. And his circulating tumor DNA, interestingly, was positive for a relatively low-level FGFR2 amplification, 2.6 copies. And so in the future, maybe this will raise the issue of he would be a full FOX FGFR2 plus PD-1 person, but till we have that data, we don't know. The TMB was low, which is consistent with the vast majority of these patients. And so this is a relatively recent case, and this patient was started on frontline full FOX and nivolumab at standard every two-week dosing. And he had a fantastic, really almost a near complete response with normalization of his CA19-9. And then our practice in these patients has been to transition to 5-FU and nivolumab as the maintenance strategy. And I think to the listeners, I'm a little bit hesitant to drop chemo entirely and go from full FOX right to nivolumab alone maintenance. And so our general approach has been full FOX kind of 3 months or more, and then start to think about if we're running into thrombocytopenias or neuropathy. But I'm hesitant to drop completely to nivolumab maintenance alone, although I do recognize the attraction clinically of a potential monthly nivo maintenance. But until I see some data, I think I'll probably continue with 5-FU nivo as the maintenance strategy.
So I also noticed that you mentioned the patient with IHC HER2 2+, but FISH non-amplified. Just kind of curious, if you could, would you use T-DXd in this situation? Would you use T-DXd if the patient initially had clearly HER2 and then flipped into a HER2 low situation? Again, outside a trial setting, if you could access it, would you use T-DXd?
Yeah, I think I would be a little bit hesitant in this population. As you said, HER2 low, where we haven't seen quite the level of activity. And then maybe I forgot to mention, this patient has some other alterations, MYC amplification, KRAS amplification, which are subsets which may have a little bit worse prognosis and aggressive biology, and perhaps maybe intrinsic potential HER2 modulating alterations, meaning that they may potentially decrease the efficacy. So I'd be a little bit hesitant to use trastuzumab deruxtecan for this, truly a HER2 negative by standard definition, but we actually happen to have a few trials that are looking at this, so it is something I would offer them. But I would probably reach for standard second-line therapy if this patient progresses, eating either FOLFIRI-ramucirumab or paclitaxel-ramucirumab.
I love the title of your next case, Long Rainbow. So what happened with this patient?
I brought this because I think it's really a real-world situation that we deal with that is not often discussed because these patients aren't covered in clinical trials. And so this is a lovely 70-year-old woman who presented back in 2018 with some intermittent abdominal discomfort and early satiety, always red flag symptoms in our patients. Has an interesting history of a follicular lymphoma, got R-CHOP times 6, finishing in 2017, and had been in a remission since then. Lovely woman, emigrated from Rome in the 70s, and very fit and active otherwise. She presented with these symptoms, which of course prompted a workup and the upper endoscopy, which showed a large mass in the gastric body. This was a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma with mucinous and signet ring cell features. She had a baseline PET CT that really didn't show much at all, a 7-millimeter perigastric node, but no clear distant disease. And then consistent with a lot of these diffuse type cancers, often they're not PET avid at all. And so the primary tumor in this case was not really PET avid. And that's something just to keep an eye out for in the signet ring and diffuse and mucinization. So our team was relatively worried about this mass and the potential for occult peritoneal disease. And so we, consistent with our practice for the vast majority of our patients, put her through a staging laparoscopy, where she was unfortunately found to have a small omental nodule adjacent to the primary tumor. Whether this was a replaced lymph node or truly peritoneal disease, we had some initial debate, but regardless to say it was positive. And then her cytology, the washings were read out as atypical, which is always very worrisome when I see that in these diffuse patients. And I essentially clinically think of that as essentially a positive cytology. She had an elevated CA19-9 at baseline. Her biomarkers were HER2 IHC0, mismatch repair proficient. She was PD-L1 positive from the primary tumor. And then, as I said, we had this omental biopsy. We ran biomarkers on that. And as an example of some heterogeneity, this is another IHC0 PD-L1 negative CPS less than 1. So the primary was positive. I think the score was like 2. And the omentum, these are both pretreatment, was negative with a CPS score clearly less than 1. Consistent with these diffuse type cancers, again, an interesting point that I think many people have seen clinically is that ctDNA is often undetectable in these diffuse type cancers. They're just relatively low shedding, or the disease is confined to the peritoneum. And so there was nothing detectable by circulating tumor DNA. So she got standard frontline FOLFOX. We don't generally do the bolus 5-FU with the frontline FOLFOX. And she did okay. So she got 5 months out of FOLFOX. But at that time, we dropped her oxaliplatin a little bit earlier. Her CA19-9 had normalized. Again, there was really nothing to see on imaging. So we were following the CA19-9 and her symptoms. And then in August of 2019, her CA19-9 began to rise back up into the abnormal level. And she again had similar kind of symptoms of early satiety. We scoped her. She had a persistent tumor. And then really to understand her disease, we put her through another laparoscopy. And now she had clearly increased in the number of omental deposits. So we considered that progression, even though there was no clear like RECIST or radiographic progression. And then we began her on second line paclitaxel and ramucirumab. And this is October of 2019. And actually, since then, she has been on, not missed maybe one or two doses in now what is approaching 2 years of paclitaxel and ramucirumab. Her CA19-9 normalized, her symptoms resolved. Her blood pressure went up a little bit. We ultimately put her on angiotensin receptor blockade, and she's not had other issues. I think maybe a clinical point is that in these patients, we've often modified the rainbow dosing regimen and given the paclitaxel and the RAM every 2 weeks. It's a little bit more convenient for patients on the long-term regimen, and I think has a little bit lower rates of cytopenias. I really brought this as a representative case of diffuse type gastric cancer as being very difficult to monitor with lack of imaging findings. These are patients who we don't see reflected in clinical trials because they don't have measurable disease, so they often don't go on studies, which is another separate big problem. But also a reminder that second line therapy can be active. This woman has had 2 years of excellent disease control. I'm not sure she has any active disease at this time on standard of care second line therapy. So I think there's a lot of interest in, of course, biomarker selection, and I'm a strong believer in that, but standard second line therapies can still be effective. And here's a good example. So I just thought it was a nice case highlighting a few clinically relevant points.
And of course, your reference to RAINBOW was the RAINBOW study looking at paclitaxel ramucirumab, but there was another study, I can't remember the name of it, that was just ramucirumab. Are there any situations where you'd hold off patients with peripheral neuropathy or use something besides paclitaxel, or you'd ever use RAM alone?
Yeah, so that study was called REGARD. I guess I could rethink my title, but yes, it's very rare that I would use single agent ramucirumab from the get-go, because we happen to have other available options usually in the trial setting. But there have been some situations where chronic paclitaxel administration and the cytopenia has become too problematic, or neuropathy has become cumulative. And in those patients, I have used single agent ramucirumab transition to that as almost a maintenance strategy. So I think it's very reasonable in patients who develop issues with whatever chemo you're combining, whether it's paclitaxel or a FOLFIRI. But I would say I don't arbitrarily drop the paclitaxel at a predefined period. And in fact, this patient has been extremely hesitant to take any breaks. There's no measurable disease. Her 19.9 is normal and she has no symptoms. So we've discussed treatment holidays completely, or at least taking a break so she can do something. But she's very clear that she wants to continue every 2-week therapy.
So let's hear about your last case, a patient who got TDXD.
Yeah, so I think I wanted to bring this just because it's a new agent, and I think we're all still gathering increasing experience with it. But this is a 76-year-old guy who presented with dysphagia back in March of 2019, had a 25-pound weight loss, similar kind of symptoms to what we see in these patient populations. He had accumulated typical medical comorbidities, had some coronary disease, had an embolic stroke with no subsequent sequelae, and then preserved EF with some moderate MR. He's a relatively active guy, retired lawyer, and really no significant family history. So his initial workup was just notable for a large GE junction mass. This was a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. I put a couple images of his baseline PET just highlighting the multistation adenopathy. And interestingly enough, and I think this maybe is an anecdotal observation, but maybe other people have seen the same, people with HER2 positive disease often present with a distribution of disease that is a lot of nodal and hepatic and often bulky nodes. So this scan is kind of consistent with what I think I tend to see with the HER2 positive patients. He had a baseline elevation in CA19-9 and CEA, which are markers that I tend to check in all the newly diagnosed patients. And then our biomarker testing, he was HER2 IHC3+, mismatch repair proficient. And as an aside, it's almost extremely uncommon, if not mutually exclusive, to have a mismatch repair deficient tumor that's HER2 positive. So these are almost mutually exclusive populations, but HER2 IHC 3+, mismatch repair proficient, and PD-L1 positive with a score of 2. Actually, he was diagnosed outside our institution and we were unable to do tissue next gen sequencing and we just didn't get a baseline circulating tumor DNA. So he was started on frontline therapy, and this is back in the middle of 2019 with CAPOX and trastuzumab, had a partial response, and I'm just showing the decrease in his biomarkers there. And then he was transitioned to capecitabine and trastuzumab maintenance and had good tolerance. And what was notable with serial imaging was just a slow increase in these initially kind of equivocal lung nodules, which kind of declared themselves over time. And then after about the better part of a year of frontline therapy, his markers began to rise again. As I mentioned, the CT had some increased nodules and increasing and recurrent adenopathy, which at the time we really couldn't biopsy safely. And then in April of this year, when the progression became quite clear, we had a discussion about second line therapies. And this was a little bit after the time that trastuzumab deruxtecan data had been out and the approval had happened, and he was an extremely well-informed patient and was very interested in moving forward with second-line trastuzumab deruxtecan. And so that is indeed what we did. And just to highlight the point you made earlier about the interstitial lung disease, and I think this is an example that a lot of people in practice can probably relate to. And so this is a man who's continued now about 5 months of trastuzumab deruxtecan. And so I put some serial imaging up here. And he really did well with the drug overall. I would say he had some mild cytopenias, which are, of course, known to occur. He had some mild fatigue, but he was completely asymptomatic from a pulmonary standpoint. He was active and exercised, no shortness of breath. But what we saw were these asymptomatic CT changes. So A in the upper right is the normal lung pre-trastuzumab deruxtecan. B is roughly the same level around 6 or 8 weeks after starting. And really, there's a minimal there. And then on C and D, what you start to see is this evolution of this really kind of non-specific findings in the lungs. Ground glass, opacities is some of the terms our radiologists have used. But whether this was small aspirations or interstitial lung disease, obviously the differential can be broad, but in light of the fact that he was on the drug and had these radiographic findings, it just calls the attention that often this can be clinically silent development, and this is a case of potential interstitial lung disease. And in fact, initially we continued him through between B and C and D, and thus far has not had any symptoms. So I'd call this essentially a grade one.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Klempner, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.